Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast with me, Vas Christodoulou. John Higgs is one of my favourite writers, and regular listeners will remember our conversation last year about the psychedelic legacy of William Blake. Now John's back with a new cultural history, this time telling the parallel stories of the Beatles and James Bond. In Love and Let Die, he investigates how and why Britain produced not one, but two global phenomena that are still profoundly loved and influential today. Why did the Beatles really split up? Is Daniel Craig's James Bond, quote-unquote, super woke? And how did these twin icons of British culture change the national psyche forever? John answered all these questions and more. Heads up, this episode discusses adult themes, including sex and violence in real life, not only in works of fiction, and is not one to listen to with kids. Here's our conversation. John Higgs, welcome back to the How To Academy podcast.
It's great to see you. Thanks for having me.
You've written quite a lot about the counterculture of the 60s and 70s in books about Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson, among others. But this time, you're tackling some of the most mainstream and popular works of that era, telling the parallel stories of the Beatles and James Bond. And to put it mildly, these are extremely well-documented parts of our culture already. So why did you want to write this book?
I think because they are so domestic. So they are such a part of our lives. They feel so familiar. We don't really look at them that much or that deeply. We just take them for granted. They're always there. You know, they don't seem strange in any particular way until you start looking at them. And then you realize just how unbelievable they are, really. How the idea that, say, you know, you could make a film character who's going to go on for 25 sequels and over 60 years, and every film would make money and every film would be a success. It just doesn't work like that. The films don't happen in that way. If they did, all the film producers would be churning them out like that. And in a similar way, the idea that a band could do what the Beatles did, you know, no one believes that anymore. No one expects, if they form a group with their mates, that they would impact on culture to the extent that the Beatles did and be discussed decades and decades later. They are monsters, really. They're monsters in the cultural landscape. They're not normal. And it just felt helpful if you put them together and look at them together, you might sort of learn things about them rather than looking at the Beatles versus the Kinks or the Who or other 60s bands or, you know, action cinema in general. They're odd things, and it's worth flagging that up, I think.
And Love Me Do, the first Beatles album, and the film version of Dr. No both came out on the same day. And in your mind, it's not an exaggeration to say this was a major turning point in the history of British culture.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was particularly significant because of the time that it was, which was after the Suez crisis in the 1950s. The Suez crisis is generally regarded at the point where Britain had to admit to itself that it was no longer a global superpower, that it could not throw its weight around on the global stage, that the days of empire were over. And that was the story of Britain for at least a couple of centuries earlier, the notion that, you know, Britannia ruled the waves and the sun never sets on the British Empire. And that was the story of who we were. And then that ended. And it just left the question, well, who are we now? You know, there was this sort of pause, there was this sort of gap. So for these two very opposing and different visions of what it is to be modern, to be British and modern, to sort of suddenly appear at the same time, did feel significant. And I do think they both had probably because of their global success, just this incredible global success, I think they have shaped how people see us and how we see us as well.
Why does the cultural imagination matter? Like, why write a book about the British psyche that is told through the perspective of the Beatles story and the Bond story rather than just more conventional history?
Yeah, most histories tell the story of power, right? That's what they do, whether that's military power, symbolic power, you know, economic power, you know, like the British East India Company or something like that. Our histories are accounts of the shifts and the changes of real power. And that's kind of hard to connect with, because most people don't have power and are a bit sort of suspicious of it. The idea that the imagination, that culture has, you know, an equal impact in those terms, it looks a bit ludicrous. People are very dismissive of it, but it's really isn't the case. I think power and imagination, they're a bit like fire and water, right? They're opposite. They're very different. They impact on things in a very different way. But the end result, you know, can be devastation. You know, you can be destroyed as much by a tsunami as you can by a forest fire. They're very sort of powerful things. And culture is important and ideas are important because, you know, ideas shape attitudes and attitudes shape actions and actions shape history. So deep down, if you do want to understand who we are and where we've come from, the ideas that we connect with and that play on us and that we sort of are drawn to are absolutely part of that story and probably an underexplored part of it, I think.
Keeping with the theme of paired opposites, the thesis of the book more broadly is that the Beatles and Bond represent the two opposing drives of the human psyche, at least according to Freud, which is to say love for the Beatles and death for James Bond. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
It's a poetic conceit, obviously, but it's such an appealing one, such an obvious one. You're right, Freudians do talk of Eros and Thanatos as the love drive and the death drive as the two sort of opposing forces that we struggle with in our psyches. And people do immediately think of love when they talk about the Beatles. And Bond is obviously death. He has a license to kill. His films are like A View to a Kill, Die Another Day, No Time to Die. You know, they fit so well into those categories. But I kind of think that the notion that Thanatos, the death drive, should be explored in action cinema fits really well, because we have this drive. We are sort of, part of us does want to like see a car crash and see something violent, stuff like that. And this can have huge social and horrible implications, but action cinema is a sort of a safe way to sort of acknowledge this part of us, acknowledge that we are drawn to these sort of things in a way that doesn't damage others. And in a similar way, Eros, love, the opening yourself up to something larger, to sort of letting go of your individualism and becoming more, that fits the world of music beautifully. That's, you know, because that's what happens when we listen to music. We just give ourselves to it and we open ourselves up to it. So for Eros and Thanatos to appear in pop music and action cinema does make a weird kind of sense to me.
The other paradigm here at work, of course, is that the Beatles are working class, generally liberal, progressive sort of hippies, and Bond represents the imperial establishment and celebrates that unashamedly. So can you speak a little bit about that dichotomy?
Yeah, I think so. I think, as I said, both when they appeared were seen as modern. Like they were both very modern, but they were modern in very different ways. For Bond, it was about, you know, fancy cars and great clothes and, you know, flying to, say, places like Jamaica were incredibly exotic when the book started to come out. You know, there was no package holidays in those days. And for him to go to all these beautiful parts of the world was just, it was so attractive and so appealing to people. But Bond's modernity was that things would get better. We'd have better gadgets, we'd have better toys, but the attitudes would stay the same. The attitudes to women, to empire, they weren't to be changed. The Beatles, again, absolutely the opposite. They were all about different attitudes. They were all about different ideas to sexuality, to drugs, to Eastern religions, to all the things that we think of when we associate with them. But in terms of Britain, they were quite happy to sort of feel nostalgic and, you know, draw on the sort of the faux Victoriana of Sgt. Pepper's and songs about like their childhood, Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields Forever. They were about, we need to be modern. It needs new attitudes, new ideas. Where for Bond, it was like to be modern, keep things exactly the same. We'll just have new toys and new gadgets and things like that. So again, you can't help when you just put the two together. There's a real dialogue just starts up between them. And it's really helps you see them in a new way, get a new perspective on them, just putting them alongside each other, I think.
The Beatles and Ian Fleming all had very tough and difficult childhoods. even though they were from opposite ends of the class system. And this leaves its mark in their adult work. Can you speak a little to that?
It was quite a shock to me when I realised the extent to which almost every single character I was writing about was not brought up in a nuclear family, was either had a parent who died or a parent who left them, or they were given away, or they were sent to boarding school, or they were raised by nannies. It was only really George Harrison and George Martin who had come up in a normal nuclear family.
Remind listeners who George Martin is.
Oh, George Martin, he's the Beatles producer. He's basically the fifth Beatle. You know, he's we wouldn't have what we think of the Beatles without him. He was the guy down in London who they were very, very lucky to find. But people like Yoko Ono, Linda McCartney, the early Beatles like Stu Sutcliffe and Pete Best, their managers, Brian Epstein, Alan Klein, all their upbringings were different in some way. And it does make a real impact on a child, especially if they've experienced death, which we think of as quite an adult way of viewing the world, to sort of know that. To grow up as a child who loses a parent, you have kind of an adult and a childish view of the world at the same time. And it does mark you out as different in some ways. And there has been a lot of talk about, you know, eminent orphans, this phenomena where the children who've lost a parent are overly represented in high-achieving individuals. But at the same time, prisons are full of people who weren't raised by both their parents. It can really go either way. And it figures so much in the story of people like John Lennon and Ian Fleming as well, I think, that their upbringing, that you can't really avoid that subject. Yeah, I didn't expect that to be such a big theme when I started the book, but it really, really was.
And you point out at one point in the book that, in fact, the James Bond stories are full of orphan characters as well.
Very much so, yeah. Very much so. But, you know, part of this was, it was after the war, so it was a lot more normal at that point to have lost a parent, or a parent has gone away and not sort of come back. But it does jump out of you as a very significant theme, I think.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
It might surprise listeners who are only familiar with Bond from the MGM films that in Fleming's books, he is a vicious, cruel, and psychologically damaged man, in ways that, to your mind, reflect the real values and real personality of Ian Fleming, with the addition that Bond is extremely competent and doesn't suffer for his actions. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's often commented on the extent to which Bond was Ian Fleming's fantasy version of himself, in that, you know, Ian Fleming was getting to middle age, his health was starting to go. So all things like that could be fixed for this fantasy version of himself. Whereas Ian Fleming was pretty much behind a desk for most of the war, sending people off to fight, never in danger himself. His fantasy version was far braver and was out sort of fighting. But the amount of his own, of Ian Fleming's attitudes and opinions that he just pours into the character of James Bond really give you a real insight into him. He's a mouthpiece for him in many ways. On subjects like drinking coffee versus drinking tea, little things like this, you just get a real sense that Fleming has invented his idealized self. And to modernize, there's a lot in there that you just wince. You know, there's no two ways about it. A lot in there is, if it was to come out now, there'd be an uproar. You know, it wouldn't be accepted in 2022. a lot of the attitude he certainly displays. But it is a very honest depiction of himself. And I think that's partly, you know, most authors, in fact, would love to create a character that sort of steps off the page and becomes real to people, has a life outside the books and survives for decades and decades and decades on, becomes a global icon. You know, authors love to do this, but they can't. It's too hard. Somehow, Fleming, by pouring enough of himself into this character, made him three-dimensional enough, real enough, interesting enough, you know, to warts and all step out of the books and into, you know, the global culture.
And complaints about Bond being a reactionary and a bigot and an awful man are not actually new. He's always been behind the curve, even in the 60s, right? That's part of the formula for his success.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's certainly Bond is never, you know, ideologically, you couldn't ideologically defend Bond in any way, shape or form. He's always behind the curve. But it is important to recognise the extent to which the character has changed over the last 60 years, particularly after Ian Fleming died. The character sort of very quickly began to move away from how Ian Fleming saw him to try and track what it was that men wanted to be, sort of this idealized version of masculinity. And the character just shifts and moves over the decades to sort of follow what that is. So, as I say, though it's not, no one's going to, you know, defend it on ideological reasons, it does mark a real shift and a shift in the right direction in terms of how men think of themselves and how men think they should act in the world to women and all these sort of things. So you get now to the extent where when the last Bond film came out, No Time to Die, for the Daily Mail, the word woke, you know, wasn't enough. And they had to coin the phrase super woke to describe James Bond at this point, which is kind of funny when you look at the long arc of James Bond, that people react to him in that sort of way at this sort of time.
Even when you watch the film, he's not particularly progressive in the film. He's just...
Exactly. He has to still be James Bond. But again, to the Daily Mail, that was the super woke version of him.
Dear, oh dear. Who is your favourite Bond? And I'm going to say Timothy Dalton is mine, controversially, and partly because it annoys people, but genuinely I do think he's a good actor and he's making serious movies.
Yeah.
There's a lot to say for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a very common choice in Bond fandom, Timothy Dalton. And they admire the way he sort of moved the character much closer to Ian Fleming's vision of it. But Sean Connery, Roger Moore, they both knew that the character needed humour. They both knew that he needed to move it away from that. I think Daniel Craig might be my favourite at the moment. Not saying that, you know, you can't criticise and find flaws in his string of films, but I think a lot of people go for Connery, but the fact that he does force himself on women who clearly do not consent in two of his films is being talked about now in a way that, you know, we'd just grow up and those films would be on TV on bank holidays and no one would say a thing and it would just be seen normal. And because he was so handsome and charming and he was Sean Connery, for God's sake, you know, people just seem to accept it. But now people, the director of the last film, for instance, has talked about it and in press conference. Now people are starting to go, yeah, that's rape. Yeah, that's rape.
Well, and Connery himself was in favour of domestic violence.
He stuck to that position for many decades. I think it was only, 2007 that he finally recanted and said that violence against women was not acceptable. That was a position he was very different to his earlier stances in earlier interviews over the preceding decades on that subject.
Your favourite Beatle, I think it's fairly clear from the book, is Paul. Tell us why that is.
That's interesting. I don't think I have a favourite Beatle. For me, it's the combination of the four. There's a strange alchemy happens when the four of them working together. It's bigger than any of them as an individual, and that's what I'm very much drawn to there. But I definitely think Paul McCartney's time has come round. I think he makes sense now in a way that he didn't in the 70s and the 80s. And in the, you know, when I was growing up, he was such a mocked figure and critically sort of, he was a joke, you know, it was wacky macker, thumbs aloft. And his attitudes, his first solo album, he said, was about love, home, family. And people just thought that was embarrassing at that time. You know, that's not what they wanted from their rock stars. They wanted sort of, you know, golden gods. They didn't want, you know, family, my God. But he stuck to those guns and kept that strange cloak of sort of faux orderliness around him. So now in the 21st century, people respect that. They his attitudes really chime, particularly with Generation Z and their values. So suddenly he's shot up so much in people's estimation, and things like the Get Back film was a big part of that, because the story was that he was just like, you know, he was the dad, you know, he was the hectoring sort of, you know, annoying do your work lads boss. He was the boss figure. And having seen Get Back, I think people are much more on his side. You know, he's trying to get something to go, obviously, but he's also quite sort of emotionally sensitive to how the others are and things like that. So, yeah, it's definitely Paul McCartney's day, I think, at the moment.
The McCartney and Lennon partnership is, of course, one of the greatest creative collaborations of all time. Mm. And you see it through the lens of genuine love.
Yeah. Yeah, and absolutely. And it's, and again, that's another thing that's been changing. And again, in that 70s, the 80s, that sort of period, people writing about the Beatles, male music journalists writing about the Beatles, did so through the lens of competition. And the question was like, well, who was the best? Was it Paul? Was it John? And the consensus was that John was the best. And that was how they tried to understand the Beatles back then. But now I think we realize that it's the relationships between the four. That's where the real story is. That's where the real sort of magic lies. You learn far more from seeing the whole thing as a love story than you do some, you know, arguments about, you know, which of these two men is best. And it's sort of unleashed an awful lot of really interesting insights into their music, into their collaboration, into their story. And their story has just got richer the more we know about it, the more we look at it, the more we study it. I do think it is the most studied event in history. I think it happened just as mass media began, and they became the most famous people in the entire world. And for that 10 years they're active, every camera, every tape recorder, every notepad was sort of pointed at them day in, day out. They were the most recorded event. That's to the extent that people are still studying it and still finding, you know, new insights into it. It doesn't get dull, the Beatles story. It's very odd. Any other band, you think, well, I've got it now. I've got what they've got to offer me now. I got the story. I know the characters, you know, and you start to lose interest. But the more you know about the Beatles, the better it becomes. It's odd. It's kind of like they're infinite. They're this infinite event.
What went wrong in the Lennon-McCartney relationship, in your understanding of it?
You know, as I was saying earlier, when I was talking about the relationship between the four, that was the sort of the early days. They really were this gestalt entity. They were, you know, people used to talk of them as the four-headed monster. I think that was Mick Jagger's phrase. And they hung out together and they'd finish each other's sentences. And they were at the center of this, you know, extraordinary storm of global Beatles mania, and they were sort of crammed together like a diamond. They were sort of under such pressures that they had each other and they fitted perfectly. But they grew. They grew as men. They grew up. They matured, and so they became different. So they didn't quite fit together in exactly the same way. And there were a couple of cracks in there from the very start. One was that George was looked down upon a little, especially by Paul. And the other was, you know, John and Paul were very, very different emotionally to the extent to which they put their, you know, their heart on their sleeves. They do differ quite a lot. And I kind of think John needed more from Paul than, you know, there's a little bit of reserve in McCartney, just a little bit of reserve that Lennon couldn't quite crack, and it wasn't enough for him. And, you know, Yoko came along, and the choice was sort of made. So yeah, they fitted together perfectly at the start, but then they grew and they changed. And, you know, that's the whole thing with love. That's why it's the story of love. You know, love dies. Death doesn't die. It's love that dies. But the fact that it existed, that's what matters. You know, the fact that it existed, that's enough with love.
Insofar as you can attribute the breakup of the Beatles to a single individual, you go for John.
Well, John did leave. He was the one who split up the Beatles and left them. If I had to blame a single individual, I suspect I'd probably go for Alan Klein and his decision, because Alan Klein was a big manager, rock and roll manager. He handled the Rolling Stones and other people, and his ambition was to get the Beatles. And his approach to doing that was very much divide and conquer. It was like, if I can get John, then I'll have the Beatles, you know. And so it was all out for getting John, and supporting Yoko was part of that. And he knew that George and Ringo would come to him, but Paul wasn't having it. And it was just at that time where they just needed to, cracks were appearing in their relationship. And if they'd had spent time together and learned to communicate properly, it didn't have to break. It could have continued. It could have sort of gone on. But the business problems of John wanting to go with Alan Klein, who was seen even then as a bit of a crook and a bit of a criminal, and Paul not wanting that, it was just that added layer that I do think without that, we might have had a good few more years of them.
John was as damaged as Fleming in many ways, and both he and Fleming treated women appallingly throughout their lives. Can you speak a little to that?
Yeah, this is certainly true. The difference being, I think, that John came to recognise this part of his himself and try and change. Now, it's not to say that he was completely successful in this. Certainly in the 1970s, when he'd had a drink, he was not good to be around. But the fact that he was aware that he came from quite a violent culture, He sort of came from a culture where, you know, men were men, and it was that post-war thing of how we're sort of supposed to act. And he did slap Cynthia, his first wife, before they got married, which is often raised, you know, in the story of John Lennon, that sort of violence against women and that thing. And you can find it in songs like "Run for Your Life," you know, which it can make you wince a bit these sort of days. But the whole thing with John is he's basically the wounded healer archetype. You know, he is damaged, but he's trying to get better, which is, when there's an unideal situation, that's all we can hope for, is to aim to get better and to start to get better and to try and sort of move on. So I think that sense of John as this damaged person who's brave enough to recognize the dark side of himself and strong enough to at least try to sort of move away from the way he was raised or brought up or whatever, is very important. You don't get that with Fleming, although obviously he was sort of much older and less likely to change, certainly by the time he came into fame and the Bond thing became such a global success.
The Bond films have largely replicated Fleming's toxic behaviour towards women, no matter how much the producers seem to attempt to, or say they're attempting to, imbue the female characters with agency. They always manage to fall short.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the amount of times when they'll announce, oh, this isn't like the old Bond girls, you know, this new Bond girl, she's not like the old ones, as if it wasn't them who just created all the old Bond girls. But the amount of actresses who've done that speech, I'm not a normal Bond girl, very clearly shows you that something's up. And there's been many attempts to change the female characters, maybe by giving them more agency, you know, making them stronger in certain ways. But it just boils down to, the problem isn't the women, you know. The problem is Bond. The problem is that baked into the character of Bond is this notion that after he sleeps with women, they die. And it's there in the very first novel, Casino Royale. And it just runs through the films. Again and again and again, which makes the final film really interesting.
Well, let's just put a note in the podcast. Anyone who hasn't seen No Time to Die, you might want to skip ahead a few minutes.
That makes it really fascinating, because the notion that after Bond touches women, they die, becomes part of the plot. It's expressed on the level of narrative. It's this complicated story. There's nanobots that are programmed to people's DNAs, and it's a big elaborate sort of excuse, which basically says if Bond touches the woman he loves, she will die. And this is what causes Bond to sacrifice himself, because he's recognized the problem on the only level that he can, which is the level of story. It's finally been expressed on the level of story. So it will be very interesting to see where they go now that this has finally been addressed. It was noticeable in the Daniel Craig films that every woman he slept with died up until Strawberry Fields, which was a very much a Beatles film themed Bond girl, which is played by Gemma Arterton. And she had written this short story about her character, about how she thought her character should be. It was like an alternative reality where the woman behaved how Gemma Arterton thought she should have done. And hence she survives, and hence she lives to fight another day. And after Gemma Arterton, it sort of stopped. All the notion that he sleeps with women and they die, it all just fell away, and it doesn't seem to be it seems to be something they've become aware of, and they're not sort of, you know, they're not going to do anymore. So once Bond reappears, it will be fascinating to see how that aspect of him is addressed.
He might finally be non-toxic.
I think when he reappears, I think, because the whole point of Bond is he is the dream men have of how they should be. And I think men now, you know, when Bond comes back, he'll be a millennial. He'll be in his early 30s. The sexual world is more complicated and harder to navigate. But the fantasy is to be able to navigate it, to be able to handle it all effortlessly, to sort of do the right thing and know what the right thing to do is. That's who we want to be. We don't want to go back to how it was in Ian Fleming's day. You know, so it will be fascinating to see where this character goes and how they address things like this.
You sort of uncovered in your research that Gen Z don't love Bond, and they haven't been sort of onboarded to Bond through their childhoods in the same way as previous generations, because they don't grow up in a one-screen house watching Bond films with their parents on bank holiday or what have you. And do you think that poses a serious threat to his future?
Yeah, obviously it seems to. I mean, if you go to say something like Comic-Con, no one is cosplaying as Bond. You know, no one is dressing up as Bond. In many ways, he is everything they are against. You know, imperialistic, misogynistic, white male, establishment figure, death, you know. So it's very tempting to think, oh, I think this could be the end of Bond. But people have been saying this is going to be the end of Bond from about 1967. Every film that's come out since You Only Live Twice, there's been reviews going, yeah, that's enough, lads. It's time. You know,
Connery had those views himself.
Yeah. You get them. You had them all through the 70s. You had them to the 80s, through the 90s, through the 2000s, up to the modern film. There's always these reviews. And yet it just goes on. There is something of tradition about it. There is something of the fact that death does not die about it, that normal rules don't seem to apply. So I would be very hesitant to predict the demise of the character as a big franchise, even fully acknowledging the extent to which it has lost the, you know, the teenage audience and the young audience. And it will be difficult, because whoever they go with next, assuming they're going with someone in their early 30s, you know, as I say, this is a millennial Bond. This is someone who grown up with dating apps and hookup apps and something like that. And this is very sort of casual and uninteresting. And it's so different to Ian Fleming's notion that for a man to be a bit of a slut was classy, which is sort of baked into it. And a modern Bond is kind of going to be like Harry Styles, someone like that. And for older Bond fans, I don't think they're going to like that. I think they're going to really struggle with a sort of Harry Styles type Bond. So the producers have this dilemma of, if they keep existing old Bond fans happy, it will just die off and dwindle in due course. if they do need to bring that next generation in. It happened in the 90s, you know, with the GoldenEye 007 video game and the whole sort of Pierce Brosnan relaunch around Britpop and that sort of spirit of Cool Britannia and things like that. It brought a whole new generation on board. So it can happen, but it'd be very, you know, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy to do it again in the current climate, yeah.
To finish up, since this is the How To Academy and we like the occasional practical insight, what can we learn from the Beatles and from Bond about the nature of creativity and art more generally? Putting aside the issue that no one can ever replicate the Beatles or Bond.
Well, from the Beatles, you learn the power of change, basically. Whatever they did, they then did something else. They never repeated themselves. They were sort of refused to repeat themselves. It was the competition between John and Paul, always trying to outdo each other, always trying to come up with something better. It's very different to modern bands who are sort of advised to have a recognizable style that's, you know, you do something that people like, so you then keep doing it for another five albums. Beatles are not like that in any way, shape, or form. And the way their creativity snowballed when they allowed themselves that freedom, I think, is a very important lesson and something well worth looking at. Bond, in contrast, teaches us of the power of tradition, power of just keep going on, just maintaining, just doing it and doing it and not giving up and never giving up and keep going and keep going. That has a magic to it. That has a power. And that's worth learning as well. Yeah, I think those are the two main lessons.
John, thank you so much for returning to the How To Academy podcast. Love and Let Die is out now from all good bookshops.
Lovely to talk to you. Thanks, Baz.
This episode starred John Higgs and was produced and presented by me. The editor is John Doughty, and the series is co-produced by me and Esme Bright, with help from Nicole Wong. If you loved it, review us and share it with your friends. Until next time, I'm Vas Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.